Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business. I'm your host, Patrick Gray. Risky Business is hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting and sponsored this week by Microsoft. You used to hate them and now you kind of look up to them and you're feeling a little bit confused and conflicted about the whole thing, admit it. Microsoft is sort of like that but ugly and socially awkward boy or girl you went to school with who grew up to be a millionaire fashion model who also cured cancer, you know? Who'd have thunk it? Anyway, on this week's show, we'll be chatting with StratSec's chief technology guy, Nick Elsmore, about bank fraud liability. A couple in the USA who fell victim to a phishing scam are suing their bank to get their money back. Nick's not a lawyer, but he's one of those guys who follows the law as it relates to security very, very closely, and he'll be along soon to have a chat about that. We'll also check in with the head of Australia's domain name regulator, OUDA, Christis Payne. A couple of years ago, an Australian domain name registrar had its credit card database walked out through the perimeter. And that's led to OUDA taking court action. And by the looks of things, it's set to drag out a bit longer. Chris will fill us in later. And in this week's sponsor interview, we're joined by Microsoft's Stuart Strathdee. And that one's a bit of a mixed chat about all sorts of stuff. We're talking all things Microsoft in that one. And there has been a lot of Microsoft-related news over the last month or so. But first, it's time for a check of the news headlines with Adam Metalstorm Buello. And Adam, you know, we often talk about how much money the bad guys make by selling Viagra, installing malware, and doing all the funky stuff that they do. But one of the guys at Sophos has put his thinking cap on and has actually tried to put some dollar figures on how much these guys make, and it looks like a pretty decent living.
Yeah, so they were saying, what, $4,000 a day for a spam campaign?
Yeah.
Selling illegal penis pills, that's a pretty reasonable haul, I suppose.
Is it the pills that are illegal or the penises? Because it's sort of interesting wording there.
Yeah, illegal penis pills.
Yeah, nice ambiguity. We always love that in an opening paragraph. But yeah, $4,000 a day for spamming. I mean, it's tempting, huh?
Well, yeah, it certainly does make you want to warm up the old botnet, huh?
Yeah. I mean, you know, make that much money while simultaneously helping people with their erectile dysfunction problems.
Or selling them Rolexes.
Yeah. So the other interesting stat that I pulled out of this, and it's buried right down towards the bottom of the piece, but it said that a previous investigation by a US firm found that criminals were earning up to $150,000 a week by selling those fake malware solutions called, you know,
antivirus XP.
Yeah. $150,000 a week.
It's a fair amount of cash, eh, selling crappy software.
Well, I'd imagine that there would probably be legitimate AV companies that didn't make that much. Maybe they should take some marketing lessons out of these guys' books.
Yeah, well, I guess they certainly understand that's business, don't they? I mean, you know, keeping the cost of doing the advertising down and maximizing the profit from each individual sale.
Yeah, and I suppose it doesn't hurt that they don't have any R&D overhead whatsoever.
Oh, yeah, none of those pesky drugs you have to develop or, you know, Rolexes you have to pay for.
Or signatures to develop for your antivirus solution.
Yeah. Although the question is, I wonder whether the bogus antivirus works any better than the regular antivirus.
I think it's pretty much just a hollow shell. I don't think it actually does any actual AV.
So like regular AV then?
Yeah. There you go. A bit of symmetry to it. Now, look, we'll move on to the next piece. Anyone who's interested in looking that one up, the researcher's name from Sophos is Dmitry Samoseiko. Which is Samoseiko. So if you're interested, go forth and Google and look it up. Now, in this next story, we will be covering this off in an interview later on in the program with the head of Australia's domain name regulator, OUDA. His name is Christis Payne. But there's a bloke here, he's quite well known in the business world. His name is Nicholas Bolton. He's a young entrepreneur who's been involved in a number of controversial business dealings here in Australia. But one of his companies, the one that made him his first money and elevated his profile as a businessman, was actually a domain name company. Now, they got hacked in 2007 and their credit card database got walked. Now, because he didn't own up to that and inform the regulator, it looks like his license to be able to sell and register domain names is going to get pulled.
Yeah, so obviously I don't know much about the specifics of the Australian side of this story, but I think it's really good to see that people like domain name, country CCTLD registrars are actually doing something about this. You know, I'm really taking this guy to task for failing to, you know, act in good faith in dealing with his customers after they, you know, he lost their credit card data. And I think it's, you know, seeing real business impact, you know, right up to the top on this kind of data breach, I think is a really good thing. I'm like, we need to see more of this in the market so that people, you know, start to actually wear some of the real costs.
You certainly couldn't accuse Outer of sitting on its hands, which is, it is quite rare for a domain regulator to take this sort of action.
Yeah, I think it's great. You know, it'd be interesting to follow the outcomes of the case, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, just briefly, there's another Twitter worm, just another one, but I think there's
No, not another Twitter worm.
Yeah.
Say it ain't so.
There's a few of them going around at the moment, and I've noticed one of them personally, because suddenly a lot of really attractive women in lingerie are inviting me to click on various links.
I'm sure that's not a worm.
These are the worms du jour. You know, we saw the Sammy worm on MySpace many, many years ago, and that was sort of the first big one of its kind, which is these Web 2.0 worms. And, you know, you would have thought that in the years since that, we would have learned our lesson and actually tightened up these services so this stuff couldn't happen.
I think, you know, Twitter is a prime example of specifically not tightening up these sort of services. You know, a lot of the social networking things, you know, they're very hip, very now, but also, you know, they're startups and they're, you know, competing real hard, and security is certainly not something you're going to be sitting around doing a lot of hard work on when you could be out there, you know, being the next big thing.
Well, it was interesting, you know, because Twitter really was one of those accidental success stories. And I believe the biggest challenge for them was finding enough data center space at one point. And of course, we saw that thing. I put it out on Twitter, actually, a few days ago. It turns out, I don't know if you saw this, but it turns out that the Twitter status page is actually hosted on a shared box in a different data center with something like 144,000 other websites, including such gems as fuckyeahboobies.com, which I think is quite funny.
I saw that link. Well, I mean, at least they're hosting it out of band, you know, so it's in the separate bit of the infrastructure, but yeah, maybe not with fuckyahboobies.
Yeah, yeah, that's, yeah, interesting. Anyway, strange bedfellows, you'd think. Now, speaking of Web 2.0 worms, there's a slightly more interesting one that's been going around, well, affecting one site, which is Reddit. Reddit.com, the den of all sorts of interesting people and definitely a bit of a geek hangout. There was a cross-site scripting worm that allowed the perpetrator to get anyone sort of who viewed one of the XSS-affected comments to actually post more comments and more comments and more comments, and it just sort of snowballed and went berserk.
Yeah, so I think it was they had a JavaScript hooked on the mouse over handler, and if you moused over a malicious bit of JavaScript, then it would post a reply to every comment in the thread. Man, that apparently Reddit was grinding pretty hard under that load.
Yeah, you can see the hard drive light now, can't you?
Yeah,
bing, 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 bing. That's it. Makes that sound like a coffee grinder. Now, this is some pretty interesting news, and we hear these statistics bandied about a fair bit. This story comes to us courtesy of Dark Reading, but apparently up to 9% of enterprise machines are bot infected. Now, this is obviously pretty scary news for the average CSO out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, anyone who's got a reasonable-sized fleet of machines, you know, has got to assume that they've got some machines compromised, I suppose. But, yeah, this is some pretty good numbers that maybe will get some attention amongst the CSO types.
The firm that did the research is called Dambala, and they discovered nearly 60% of the 600 botnets that they looked at contain only a handful to a few hundred bots that are built to actually target particular organizations. So it looks like, you know, you'll actually have specifically crafted malware that is just designed to really go deep into, say, a specific corporation or a specific group of corporations.
Yeah, well, I think it's a much more effective way to attack someone like this. You know, rather than trying to maintain a 6 million node botnet like the Configure guys do, which is going to get a lot of attention, and you know, you have to have a lot of infrastructure, a lot of upfront kind of work to build a bot that's going to scale that well. Whereas, you know, a couple of hundred machines, anyone can do that in an afternoon, right? That's a much more manageable task. And if you target that well, then you can use that potentially to a lot more profit than, say, something the size of Configure.
9%, though, holy Christ! I mean, that's pretty concerning. You would agree.
Yeah, well, it makes you wonder, you know, all the people out there in Podland who are listening to this, to Risky Business, you know, look around your office, you know, 1 in 10 machines, you know, look around you, how many you see, right? One of those is owned.
Yeah, but I mean, I sort of wonder with statistics like this, because surely it would depend on the environment and on who's running the security team, you would think.
In the end, though, there are desktop machines run by desktop users, and they're running Outlook and browsing the web, even if it's not your real important key signing, machines in the back of your credit card printing factory, right? Somewhere there are machines that are inside your perimeter that are internet connected and, do relatively high risk stuff. And, once you compromise one of those systems, generally it is a pretty short hop into the credit card printing or the backroom systems.
Yeah, well, I was just about to ask that, actually. I mean, that whole thing that Bill Cheswick said back in the 80s about the network perimeter being that hard shell and then the inside being gooey. I mean, how does that still hold, in your opinion? I mean, once you've got a foothold.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, because I mean, once you're on the LAN, and away you go.
Well, I mean, the same layer 2 gives you a lot of tricks that you can pull, but I mean, in general, once you're on the inside of someone's network, it doesn't take long to do things. I mean, I've had jobs where we've gone in to do a penetration test from the perspective of a malicious insider, and, sometimes it's 20 minutes, 20 minutes into a two-week, to-do job, and you've already owned the domain controller and game over.
Mm-hmm. One thing that concerns me about research like this, though, is it is done by security companies. Do you think it would be a good idea for some independent body like a university or something like that to actually conduct a similar sort of definitive study so that it's somewhat removed from vested interests?
Yeah, well, these studies always are a bit hard to interpret, aren't they? Because they always come out of, antivirus companies or malware companies, people trying to sell us some kind of silver bullet fix. I'd love to see some better statistics about who's getting owned and when and where and how. But I think that we're not going to get that until there's a body of public data being reported in some kind of control manner. And we just don't see that yet. I mean, the certs are not trusted by businesses, and there's certainly in Australia and New Zealand, no requirement to disclose data breaches.
Mm.
So, I mean, until we have enough data to do some work on, I don't know what we're going to see. I mean, someone's not going to, no telco is going to phone up a university and say, oh, by the way, we got, one of our credit card processing boxes owned.
Oh, well, moving on, Adam, and there's some Cisco bugs out there. There's 11 new Cisco criticals, so if you have Cisco stuff, go check, and you might want to patch them.
Yeah, so there's most of these appear to be reported as denial of service, but then again, we know what that means, right?
Yeah, it means they couldn't get it to trigger, or they couldn't be bothered to get it to trigger.
Dicks. But there's an interesting selection of vulns there. There's some denial of service against VPN terminators. There's some kind of bug related to GRE encapsulation and PPTP encapsulation, which is interesting if you're running VPN terminators. Those are the sort of things that are going to be on the public internet, and having those DOS may well be of relevance to your interests.
Yep. So what do we reckon? Go out and go forth and check.
Yeah, well, if you're not patching your Cisco kit already, right, you're probably got another problem.
Yeah, that is indeed true. Now, there was one aspect also of that Sophos research that I mentioned earlier by that Samoseko guy that we didn't actually mention that we probably should, which is this guy reckons the Russian cyber gangs, those big, scary Russian cyber gangs.
Yeah,
those dudes. They're actually paying 43 cents per hijacked Mac. Which is interesting, which means that Mac users are now officially they've had a value assigned to them.
Yeah, which is, I suppose that demonstrates that Mac users are now actually worth something. They have a financial value attached to them on the black market.
So this is, Mac's infected by that sort of dodgy codec, bit of malware that's also, I think, the same Trojan wound up in pirated versions of iWork. But it is a little bit interesting. I'm starting to get the impression that the Mac malware thing is just starting to ramp up slowly now. But, as we've seen with these things, it can turn exponential pretty quickly. So, I mean, what do you reckon, mate? Do you reckon it's their day is coming?
Oh, well, I think so. I mean, Mac users are generally probably going to be a pretty, hip and web-savvy bunch. I mean, they're, likely to be doing online shopping, online banking, and, perhaps Macs are going to be used for potentially more interesting things from the point of view of identity theft criminals than your average Windows system. And a lot of Windows systems sit around a business, don't do much. If you were actually looking to steal credit card data, on the per user level, rather than stealing it from card aggregators and merchants, then maybe Macs would be a pretty good target. It's kind of a niche. You're not likely to run into other botnet herders and things.
So you reckon the average Mac user is more likely to sort of live more of their life online?
Probably, yeah, I think so, and they're probably more likely to have a false sense of security or more likely to be trusting of their system than your average Windows user. I mean, I'm speculating, of course, but it seems that way to me.
Hey, unfounded speculation is what this program is all about. But that actually takes us to the end of the news, Adam. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thanks very much, Pat.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there. Now, funnily enough, we actually missed a pretty good story. It didn't make it onto our news sheet this week. Sort of a funny of the week, which is that a UK prison put a gentleman by the name of Douglas Harvard, who is 27, in charge of the prison's computer system. They wanted to set up an internal TV station, but needed some custom admin work done, and he fitted the bill quite nicely. Now, this would seemingly be a good plan, an inmate with computer skills. So, you know, good old Douglas was familiar with computers. In fact, he was serving a jail sentence, a six-year sentence, for conducting around £6.7 million of online fraud. Anyway, long story short, he basically trashed the entire network and locked out all of the other admins. So just a note to any prison admins who might be listening, if you want to get an inmate to help out with your computer network, I'd personally pick the mass murderer who used to be a sysadmin over the hardcore black hat who's in there for hardcore online fraud. I'm just saying. Now, next up, we're chatting with the CEO of Australia's domain name regulator, AUDA. That's A-U-D-A. And we're discussing the case of Bottle Domains. Now, the guy who founded Bottle Domains is actually quite well known in Australia. His name is Nicholas Bolton, and he runs a company called Australian Style Investments. They were the mob who tried to take over Briz Connections. Now, if you live down here, you would almost certainly remember the stories about that. It was huge news. So Bolton is what you would call a fairly controversial figure. Anyway, Bottle Domains was the domain name registrar that was hacked back in 2007 and, according to the domain name regulator, had failed to appropriately notify its customers. It all went to court and Bottle's accreditation got yanked. So AUDA CEO Chris Dispain joins me on the line now from the USA where he's taking part in preparations for the Cyberstorm 3 exercise. And Chris, I understand that moments ago, Bottle actually announced it would appeal the court's ruling. Is that correct?
Yes, they have. The judge today made his orders, which were a judgment in our favour and in summary, anyway, judgment in our favour and costs, but has stayed those orders for a period of time to allow Bottle to go to the Court of Appeal and apply to the Court of Appeal for an injunction pending the hearing of a full appeal of the case.
Okay, now how did we actually get to this point? Can you fill us in on a bit of the background when it comes to all things Bottle?
Yes, there was a police investigation that revolved around a registrar's database being offered for sale. That turned out to be Bottle's database, and it transpired in the investigation and in our investigations that, in fact, in 2007, there was an attempt to break into Bottle's database, or in fact, not an attempt, it was actually broken into, and under the terms of their registrar agreement with us, they and every other registrar is obliged to inform us of any security breach. The reason for that is so that we can make sure that appropriate action is taken. They don't have to inform us so that we can be nasty to them, but they need to inform us so that we can make sure that customers are fully informed if their credit card details are at risk, et cetera, et cetera. That didn't happen. And because of that and a series of other events, which I'm going to go into, we decided to terminate the registrar agreement. And they applied for an injunction to stop us from doing that pending a full court hearing. Injunctions are awarded on the balance of convenience, and quite clearly the termination of Bottle as opposed to them carrying on is catastrophic for them. And so therefore the balance of convenience lay with them.
Okay, so when was AUDA actually made aware that this breach had taken place? I'm guessing it was sometime after 2007.
Yes, we were made aware earlier this year when the database was offered for sale, and the Australian Federal Police contacted us to inform us that this database was being offered for sale on the internet. Now, it's still not clear, let me say, just so everyone understands, still not clear whether the actual database that was being offered for sale was that which was extracted in 2007 or whether it was one that was extracted at a later date. But during the course of the investigation, it became clear that there had been the security breach in 2007, and so therefore we had to investigate that.
So how catastrophic would it be to a registrar, generally speaking, to have their accreditation pulled?
Well, what it means is that that all of the customers, all of the registrants with domain names for whom they are the registrar of record, become the temporary registrar, the regulator. We become the temporary registrar, and they are then the customers then over time move to another registrar. So effectively, it means that their business as a registrar ceases. It doesn't mean that they necessarily have to stop selling domain names, because of course they could always continue to act as a reseller for another registrar. But it means that they're no longer accredited by us as a registrar. They can no longer register names in the registry in .au, and they can no longer be the registrar of record.
So it would have a fairly damaging effect on the bottom line, you would imagine.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, it's the end of that business.
Are they able to sell their customer database to another registrar at that point, or it really is that Outer comes in and seizes those names?
Yeah, we become what's called the registrar of record.
And I imagine that they would no longer be able to sort of renew those domains either.
Correct.
Which would mean a loss of a lot of recurring revenue.
Absolutely.
So why is it that Outer felt it necessary to take these steps? Is it a case where usually, just let's speak in general terms, in instances like this, do you usually try some sort of mediation before going to court?
We would terminate a registrar's accreditation in very few circumstances, because it has the effect of closing that business down. I'm not going to go into obviously into specific details on this particular case. The judgment is public, and that's, you know, stands on its own, the judge's findings. But in general terms, it's not something that we would do at the drop of a hat, shall we say. It's something we take very, very seriously. But having said that, we also take the security of our .au registrants very, very seriously, and their data needs to be secure. Their credit card details need to be secure, and they need to know if there is a problem. Now, the fact that somebody hacks into a registrar's database is not of itself a reason to terminate them. I mean, you know, there are hackers out there playing around all the time, and I've no doubt that on occasions they will be successful in hacking into various databases. They hack into government databases and so on. I'm not suggesting that registrars have to be impervious to attack. The point is that they must tell us so that we can ensure that registrants are fully aware of what's been going on, and we act as the protector of the registrants, whereas the registrar, of course, is acting to protect their business.
So when will we know more? When will this appeal be heard, or even the leave for appeal, or however it works? I imagine this is going to be a developing story. So,
well, that's right. We don't know anything other than that they have until the 23rd of October to get a hearing before the Court of Appeal to apply to the Court of Appeal to grant an injunction pending a full hearing of the appeal. And now the full hearing of the appeal could be 6-12 months away. But in the meantime, what Bottle will try to do is to persuade the Court of Appeal that in the interim there should be an injunction granted to prevent us from complying with the orders of the Victorian Supreme Court.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be one of those things that is going to drag on for a while, and I can almost hear the guys in the funny wigs with the long silk black robes licking their lips at all of the billable hours they're going to rack up over this one, Chris.
It's certainly a joy for lawyers, there's no question.
Yes, yeah. Okay, well, Chris Dispain, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business.
Not a problem.
AUDA CEO, or Outer CEO, Chris Dispain, on the line from the USA there. Now, before we get into the next feature interview, I just want to mention again that Risky.biz is looking for skilled penetration testers. We've been asked to help two different companies find staff. There is a job in Sydney and one in Melbourne, and they're basically the same type of gig. They're full-time jobs for consultants with web application security skills. So they need to do good code review and a bit of network pen testing as well, and also be, you know, human, capable of being put in front of customers. So consulting experience is a bonus. Now, the working conditions and the money are both great. So if you're interested, please email me at jobs@risky.biz. And if you refer someone who later gets the job, we'll give you a $1,000 finder's fee. So please get in touch. Back onto the show now, and we're going to have a chat with Nick Elsmore of StratSec. Nick was the founder of an Australian consultancy, SIFT, which merged with StratSec earlier this year. So in effect, SIFT was acquired by StratSec, which I gather means Nick's personal balance sheet had a few zeros tacked onto it, which is good news for him. Now, some of you may have heard that there's a couple in the USA who were taken in by a phishing scam for a considerable sum of money, and the bank has refused to refund it. The bank has basically said, you gave the bad guys your password, so you're out of luck. Well, the couple has taken the bank to court and they are suing, and they are arguing that a username and a password are not fit to protect an online bank account, and thus their money should be refunded. Now, as I mentioned in the intro, Nick isn't a lawyer, but he's one of those guys who's been following cyber law, if you want to call it very closely for a very long time, and he's worked at the pointy end of security policy development here in Australia for a long time. So I tracked him down to his diamond-encrusted, solid-gold beachfront mobile Hummer Palace for this interview, and here's what he had to say.
Look, it's an interesting argument that's been it's been coming for a while. Ultimately, most of this stuff boils down to some fairly basic sort of trade practices principles, and the core two trade practices principles are basically that products that are sold should be fit for purpose and should be of merchantable quality. And ultimately, what these arguments boil down to is that when a bank provides an internet banking service or something like that, if they only provide it with a user ID and password, then it is not actually fit for purpose of conducting financial transactions. And that's just a point that needs to be argued out and resolved, I guess.
It strikes me that that would be the case in Australia, but I mean, we're talking about this one is in the US, and they don't have a Trade Practices Act over there, from what I can tell, or similar legislation.
They don't, but they do have an approach, and again, as well as not being strictly a lawyer in Australia, I'm certainly strictly not a lawyer in the US. but my understanding is there have actually been, I guess, cases you could draw some parallels with. Quite a few years ago, there was one that actually involved Ziff Davis, and it was basically an online case. And my memory may be a little sketchy, but broadly, my understanding is that people entered their data into an online form. The form said that the site was going to protect the information appropriately. As it turned out, the data was compromised, and then there was actually a finding against the organization for essentially misleading and deceptive conduct. Which is, again, another sort of trade practices concept.
Section 52A, even I know that. All journalists know that one.
Everyone knows 52. It's a wonderful thing. You can beat anyone with it regardless of circumstance.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing is you've got to rely on the ACCC to actually do something about it before it gets to court, which never happens anyway. That's probably a little bit arcane for most of the listeners out there. But, I mean, look, the difference here is that, you know, we're not actually talking about some sort of lax security on the bank's part. Yeah. I suppose that's how they'd describe it. You know, it really is a case where the user has given up all the information that's required for someone to access their account. So I guess it is slightly different to that Ziff Davis case, isn't it? It's more of a grey area, you would agree.
Look, absolutely it's a grey area. And again, I mean, when I say that this has been coming for a while, I guess if you go back to 2001 and the Privacy Act, the security requirements around the Privacy Act is all geared towards the requirement for reasonable steps to be taken. And really, in all of these areas, we've all been, I mean, to say we've been guessing is probably unfair, but we've all been doing our best to determine what reasonable steps are and then to put them in place. And ultimately, the argument here is a user ID and password a reasonable level of security to expect for an online banking account?
Yeah, well, I think that's really at the core of the issue. And if we look at it, I mean, you would have to agree that even though these people did give up their passwords, the science of security has shown us that people are vulnerable to phishing. So any bank that's half competent with a half competent security team knows that if they're using a username and a password, science tells us it has proven that will not adequately protect all of their customers because some of them will give up those usernames and passwords. I mean, do you agree with that point?
Yeah, I think the science is part of it. I think the other part of that is in reasonable steps, in the concept of reasonable steps, I think what is probably going to be looked at is what's everyone else doing? And particularly as more and more banks move to two-factor authentication, what they are, I guess, tacitly acknowledging is that it's necessary. If it wasn't necessary, then there's a pretty good chance they wouldn't be doing it. And therefore, for the banks that are slower in moving down that path, there's certainly an argument that could be made that they are not keeping up with the necessary level of security.
Yeah, now I guess that's what's really interesting is when we actually start looking at the two-factor authentication problem and realize that Trojans have in fact already caught up and risen to the challenge, that's where it gets really awful. Now, look, before we actually get into that whole side of the argument, there are varying bankers' codes of conduct around the globe. I understand that in Australia, if you actually get suckered in by a phishing scam, the bank will actually cover your loss, whereas in New Zealand they won't. And, you know, it just sort of tends to differ from international jurisdiction to international jurisdiction. Why is that? Why is it that banks in New Zealand can say, well, we're going to feed you to the wolves, whereas banks here won't? I mean, what's driving those sorts of decisions?
I'm sure the New Zealand banks would argue that technically they're not feeding you to the wolves, but I think the discussion that occurs, and I guess the point that they make is pretty fair, and that is, if someone, I guess, genuinely, unwittingly, the first time gives up their user ID and password because they've never seen a phishing attack before, they couldn't have known any better, then I think in the vast majority of cases, that person would get their money back, including in New Zealand. I think the argument is, if having given that person their money back, the next day they fall for the phishing scam again, should the bank be continually subject to wearing that liability, or at some point does a consumer have to take the responsibility for continually falling foul of what is becoming a fairly obvious phishing scam? So I guess to a degree it tries to put some of the burden of responsibility back on the consumer. And certainly, I mean, again, if when you go and start looking globally, I'm not sure exactly what the codes of conduct are like in every country in the world, but you can be fairly safe to assume that there are large numbers of countries that either don't have a code of practice that covers something like this, or have one that is very much geared the other way, is very much buyer beware, and if you lose money, then bad luck. I think that the challenge is that it's not an area that consumers pay attention to yet.
Well, see, actually, Nick, that was one of the things I was getting at when I was asking you what drives these decisions, because I have a sneaking suspicion that if people were all of a sudden liable for phishing losses, it would hit the headlines every other day, and all of a sudden people would stop using internet banking.
So here's an interesting parallel. If you look at what happened when the global financial crisis hit with bank guarantees, with bank guarantees, you basically had, you know, certain governments guaranteeing the deposits of their banks. And what actually happened was there was a pretty significant flow of capital internationally into those countries and those banks where a guarantee was in place, which basically meant that everyone had to put the guarantee in place. You could say that if people were well informed, logically, you wouldn't have a bank account with a bank that wasn't going to provide you a degree of protection in the event of you losing your money through EFT, through some sort of electronic transaction. But I think the fact is that most people don't just have an awareness that there is actually some variation in that.
Well, look, you know, going back to this specific case, this specific instance in the US,
sure.
I'm wondering, I mean, if the case is found in favour of the couple who are pursuing it and they do get their money back, I'm wondering what sort of precedent, or indeed if a similar case happened here or in New Zealand or wherever, I'm wondering what the effect of such a precedent would be on other types of businesses, not just in banking. I mean, if you are offering some sort of online trading platform and you give up your password and username and someone uses it to completely screw over your portfolio or uses your trading positions in some sort of pump and dump scam, are you liable then? Do you see what I mean? Like, do you think this has actually potential to spread into other types of businesses as well? Think eBay, think, you know, any type of online commerce, share trading, superannuation, whatever it is, could it spread beyond this one specific example?
Yeah, look, insofar as any of those organizations could be liable, I guess, or could be subject to a similar legal case, then certainly that is true. But the reality is that's already there. I mean, the U.S., to a degree, they're certainly well known for their tendency to take things to court. To a degree, the U.S., the outcomes of U.S. court cases aren't hugely influential. But that said, at the same time, particularly when it comes to IT and IT law, they do tend to get these things a bit earlier than a lot of other countries. So while certainly there's no formal legal precedent in the sense that you're not going to get an Australian court recognising it, I think certainly it would put a lot of organisations on notice and would certainly be a little concerning, particularly if the bank argues unsuccessfully that they were taking reasonable steps and the court actually overrules them, which basically means that the court is now dictating what a bank should be doing in the area of IT security.
Yeah, but I mean, then it becomes what's reasonable. And I guess this leads me on to
And how do you find out? I mean, it's not like the bank can petition the court ahead of time to say, can you tell me what protection I need to have in place so that when a case comes up, I don't get in trouble?
Well, now this is where it gets really interesting, because while we say a username and a password is manifestly inadequate, I would suspect that even within a year from now, we'll be saying the same thing about tokens, because we've got all these real-time Trojans, man-in-browser attacks that are extremely effective, and they are becoming commonplace. I think we saw the first one of them a few years ago, and it made news. People were like, oh my God, people are doing this. And now they're everywhere.
It's a tough one, because on the other hand, I think you can also make the argument that user IDs and passwords, while certainly not strong, for many purposes, are actually sufficient. I mean, it depends. I mean, is it sufficient for conducting financial transactions? Depending on what the thresholds are, what the levels are. I mean, certainly one of the sort of more sophisticated approaches to this is to allow for user ID and passwords to conduct certain levels of transactions, and then to allow two-factor authenticated users to conduct a higher level of transaction. And as you say, I mean, if two-factor ends up also being routinely compromised, then perhaps we get to the point where there needs to be a restriction on those transactions as well. I think the question is at what point the benefit ceases to outweigh the cost. And certainly from the bank's perspective, I think that's a long way off. I think the benefit of not having to have people go into branches and deal with tellers and that sort of thing is a pretty significant financial incentive. And certainly as a user, I mean, I don't think any of us would willingly go back to things like phone banking and turning up at a branch and trying to withdraw money and that sort of thing.
Yeah, look, I don't think we would willingly either. But I mean, when I look at just how quickly the gap has been closed between the defense, the defenders and the offenders, especially when it comes to things like tokens. And then, you know, I had an interesting chat with Wade Alcorn, actually, from NGS, recently about mobile. Now, a lot of people are saying mobile's an overhyped threat. And he said, well, if you look at the developing world, everyone is using mobile devices to access the internet because they are a low-cost platform that you can use to access the internet. Yeah. So people will use them as their primary platform for doing things like banking, which means, hey, guess what? There's going to be a hell of an incentive to start writing malware for those things and spreading it out there. So that automatically rules out SMS-based authentication as a reliable factor. We already know that tokens are pretty much useless. And then people say, well, smart cards, transaction hashing. Now, that's really good. But if you've got a man-in-browser bit of malware that throws up the wrong account number, then what good is hashing a bogus transaction to begin with? So every single two-factor solution that has been put forward, we can see already, not even on the horizon, that's a little bit closer to us than just being on the horizon, that these will be subverted sooner rather than later. And we're sort of back to square one then. So what do we do? What do we do?
Yeah, look, I'm a lot more positive about these things to a degree. I mean, I think that ultimately all we're trying to do is find a solution that is, you know, broadly workable. I mean, even if you just look at user ID and password, I'm sure, okay, maybe I'm not sure. I assume that you probably still have bank accounts that just have user ID and password.
You assume incorrectly. No way.
No?
No way. That's nuts.
There are lots that still do. And certainly, I would say that a large part of the community would still have bank accounts that still have user ID and password as the sole set of authentication.
Yeah.
And I would also assume that the majority of those people don't have problems. They haven't been successfully phished. They haven't been compromised yet. Now, that's not to say that what they're doing is safe or secure or anything else. I mean, certainly I think within the security community, there are probably not that many of us who still use just user ID and password. But, I mean, look, I certainly have one or two accounts that still run off that.
That sounds like a challenge for the listeners.
Yeah. The user number is.
Yeah, that's right.
I think the requirement is really that we make sure that the majority of transactions, the majority of users are safe enough. And I think tokens and other two-factor mechanisms will certainly provide that for some time into the future. But certainly I don't think that's going to be the ultimate end result. Now, what the ultimate end result is going to be, I'm not quite sure. And there are hundreds and hundreds of patents that have been lodged for all sorts of wondrous two-factor authentication solutions. Most of them so far haven't come to a great deal, but who knows? One of them may end up getting lucky.
Mm-hmm. Nick, do you reckon that this US bank should pay that couple back their money?
Look, they're in a tough spot now. It's one of these situations where now that the case has been launched, if they pay the couple back the money, it kind of looks like they're tacitly acknowledging that that there was a weakness. I think they should. I think, in effect, as you say, if they were in Australia with the banking, the EFT code of conduct and similar things, then they wouldn't be in as big a situation. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, did the couple know ahead of time? Had they been informed that this was the risk they ran? I'm not sure. A lot of this ultimately comes down to people making what we assume are sensible risk-based decisions. But I think what we also all know is that most of those decisions aren't either sensible or risk-based.
Mm.
So who knows?
All right. Well, that's a very long way of saying,
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
All right, Nick Elsmore, thanks a lot for taking some time out to have a chat to us here on Risky Business.
Pleasure. Thanks, Pat.
StratSec's Nick Elsmore on the line there with a look at two-factor authentication and liability. Interesting stuff. Now, I should let you all know that next week's show will probably be a little bit late. I'm off to the GovCert Symposium in the Netherlands. That's the Dutch CERT. I'm leaving at the end of this week, and it's a hell of a trip from Australia to Europe, 9 hours to Taipei, a couple of hours to Bangkok, and then around 13 hours to Amsterdam. So you arrive feeling just terrific and ready for work, let me tell you. But yeah, between all the travel and the conference proceedings, it'll be a bit of a struggle to have something up by next Tuesday. That said, next week's show will be a cracker. GovCert.nl is the Dutch CERT, as I mentioned, and they host a cracking conference, and there's going to be a heap of talent there for us to speak to. So it will be late, but it hopefully will be a great show and worth the wait. Anyway, it's time now for this week's final interview, our sponsor interview. We love our sponsors, which is why we give them airtime. And this week we're chatting with Stuart Strathke, and he is the Strategic Security Advisor at Microsoft Australia. And Stuart, I want to start off with some old news that last week was made new again by the team at Fairfax. I saw this alarmist headline, top story on the Sydney Morning Herald's website saying, Internet meltdown threat. And I thought, and it said, you know, a worm is threatening to topple the internet. I thought, geez, you know, I should really be on this. I'm sort of surprised that I haven't heard anything about this. And it was a Conficker story.
Yes, it was an interesting read, that article, and a little bit surprising because Conficker, as the article highlights, and as we all know, it has been around since November last year, so I don't think anyone in the security industry would question that there is potential for a lot of damage out there, but I was surprised to see such a headline coming at this point in time.
Yeah, no, it was weird, like internet meltdown threat. It wasn't so much clouds gather on horizon, it was more imminent storm threatens village,
Yeah.
It was a little bit of creative headlining there, but Yeah,
I think one of the other interesting points, though, too, is that a lot of the comments that I've seen about Konfica makes the assumption that the one bot herder or bot master has control of all of the Konfica bots or Konfica zombies, whereas from what I've seen around some of the payload delivery and the use of Konfica, quite often you find it's only a small number of machines being used at any point in time, which tends to make you think that potentially they may have sold it off or broken it up. There were some interesting angles in some of the quotes and comments in that article.
Yeah, they're interesting. That's very diplomatic of you there, Stuart. But I guess, you know, there was another bit of reporting recently that said, that hypothesized that, you know, Konfica was this big state-sponsored thing, maybe done by the Chinese or whatever. And I just remember laughing at those claims because all that Konfica has been used to do so far is send a little bit of spam.
That's right. And I think generally we have been a little bit surprised that we haven't seen a major attack come out of this because if you've got such a powerful botnet at your disposal, then I think most of the industry was sitting waiting for to see what would happen and to see what our next steps would need to be. But then a lot of these worms, viruses, Trojans, they become a victim of their own success. What we found is that it has become the primary target of so many security firms. And that's what I was alluding to with the victim of your own success. I mean, the ideal piece of malware is a piece of malware that nobody knows about that's out there just generating income month after month or year after year.
That sounds pretty good. You reckon you can help me hook that up?
I can help you find it.
There you go. But yeah, so look, I don't think anything's really changed in the world of Konfica, has it?
No, I didn't think it had.
Well, the Sydney Morning Herald disagrees, mate.
Okay, well, I'll give them that one.
Well, in that case, yeah, they must be right. Now, look, let's move on because we've got a few things to discuss.
Yeah.
Also, we mentioned this briefly on last week's show, which is that you guys have released some more tools from that have spun off from your secure development lifecycle team. There's some sort of binary file analyzer and also a file fuzzer. A code fuzzer, which sounds like a pretty damn good idea, putting those sorts of tools out to the public. What sort of tier of companies are you expecting will actually start integrating those tools into their development processes?
Okay, so the security development lifecycle was obviously that's a change that Microsoft's taken to heart and we've implemented. And it's one of our big defense in depth strategies that we're going out and speaking to most of our enterprise customers and certainly all of our strategic customers. We're pushing that they also implement it. And the most common complaint that they were coming back to us and saying, we agree with the philosophy, we agree with a lot of the content that you've provided, but, you know, where the rubber hits the road, how do we actually get in here and review this stuff or start going back and looking at what we've already rolled out? And so these tools really are being put in place to enable a lot of those organisations. And we are talking primarily enterprise.
What enterprises that have got custom-developed in-house stuff, not so much software development houses and ISVs?
Well, software development houses and ISVs are definitely the next biggest group, I would suggest, that would use these sorts of tools as well. So it really has been feedback from both of those groups that drove us to create or release some of these tools.
So what, Larry Ellison on the phone saying, help us, please?
Maybe not Larry.
They're happy doing things the way they do things. So are those tools are actually out or are they coming soon?
As far as I'm aware, they have actually been released. So I believe that you can get hold of them now. And there's more information up on the Secure Computing website and Trustworthy Computing website.
That is the BinScope Binary Analyzer and the MiniFuzz File Fuzzer. So anyone out there with two fingers and access to Google, or I guess you would prefer Bing, should be able to find those tools. Now, we've got even more news from the world of Microsoft, which is that you guys have patched SMB V2, the so-called SMB V2.
So SMB V2, yeah, what's happened is there is currently further work being done, but there is a fix-it link available from our security websites, and there's a security advisory about the V2 investigations that are going on at the moment. And basically what you can do is you can just go and click on the fix-it link, and that will remove doesn't remove the vulnerability, but what it does is it switches you into a mode where essentially you're not vulnerable at this point in time until we get the update out.
Just changes some weird setting somewhere deep in the bowels of the registry.
Exactly.
Okay, right.
And it's much easier just to click the button than it is to go and do it manually.
Yeah, Microsoft sent a team of 12 guys into the Windows registry wearing full camo gear, and three of them have emerged. So SMB V2, a comprehensive fix, I imagine, is in the works. But one last thing, Microsoft taking some malvertising providers to court. This is a pretty interesting story. I mean, you were on the show last month or the month before talking about what an absolute pain in the hole these guys are, and it looks like you're seeking a legal remedy here.
Yeah, so it's, a situation that you've got to fight them in the virtual world and fight them in the real world. And, you hear so often the theory of follow the money. Well, sometimes following them just through normal sort of business operations channels is actually easier. And so if we can find these guys and we can locate them and mount a good case, then we're definitely going after them and trying to get convictions.
Next step, dispatch the ninjas. Seriously. Or the flying monkeys. And I know Bill Gates has been in investing in them. I mean, because come on, flying monkeys are cool and he's got the money to do that sort of thing.
Well, we have had some advertising campaigns with ninjas. We need to be careful what we say, or may come back again.
Well, that's right. I mean, be careful, everyone out there, because they weren't actors. They were, in fact, real ninjas. Well, look, mate, that's actually all we've got time for. But Stuart Strathke, thanks again, as always, for coming on to Risky Business.
A pleasure. Thanks, Patrick.
Stuart Strathke from Microsoft in this week's sponsor interview, and that rounds out this edition of the Risky Business Podcast. I'll be back next week with all of the news from GovCert in the Netherlands. And this track that you can hear now was prepared by a friend of mine, Lawrence Kennedy. It's called Voice, and it's a bit weird, sort of got a Aphex Twin vibe about it, so don't let it destroy your brain. If you're hungover, I apologise for forcing you to listen to this, but I personally really enjoy this track. Anyway, until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm.